let's try and convince everybody why they should get a heart scan, where they should get a heart scan, what kind of heart scan, all that, and who.
Let's do that.
I mean, because I know that you say anybody with a heart technically should get a heart scan.
We will do that. Right?
First of all, who should get a heart scan?
Right. Basically, the way I look at it is that by the time you reach the age that a zero heart scan means something, then you should get a heart scan. For instance, if you're 20 years old, virtually all 20-year-olds will have a zero calcium score. No value in getting a calcium score when you're zero.
Even if you have family history.
Even if you have family history. Yeah, you still want to live appropriately.
Right.
But you don't want to get it. There's no value.
Right.
However, by the time a male is 40 or a woman is 50, in the absence of significant increased risk, because an average person, man 40, woman 50, a zero heart scan means something. A zero heart scan means you're in the lower 75th percentile. Positive heart scan means something. Means you're in the top 25 percentile. Means you need to be paying attention to that. So at that age, we can start finding the highest risk people, usually many years before they're going to have their first symptom, and gives us time to shut it down, prevent it from happening. And so I say it with normal risk factors, a man age 40, a woman age 50. If you have a strong family history, if you have really high blood pressure, if you've smoked, if you have diabetes, you might want to do that first scan 5 or 10 years sooner. A man 30 to 35 or a woman 40 to 45. If you have someone in your family who's died at a young age from a heart attack, I have a cousin who died at age 45 from a heart attack. His kids should get a heart scan at least 10 years sooner than that, no later than age 35, maybe age 30. And so that's kind of the parameter that I use.
If somebody comes to you and says, Dr. Blanchette, I'm a 50-year-old female.
Mm-hmm.
I have no family history, no gum disease because I just had x-rays. I have no sleep apnea. I'm perfect weight. My cholesterol is magnificent. I don't need a heart scan, right, Dr. Blanchette? What would you say to her?
I'd say you're still more likely to die from heart disease than you are to die from colon cancer. And your doctor is going to tell you to go get a colonoscopy. Colonoscopy is a very expensive, invasive, unpleasant test that helps us find and treat colon cancer. A calcium score is a very inexpensive, reasonably pleasant test that if you are in the optimal risk group.
Meaning what I just said,
what you
right?
described, the optimal risk group, you are still as likely to die from heart disease as you are from breast cancer. Why would you not get a heart scan? You still should. Because within that group of low-risk women are a lot of women who also have heart disease.
I heard you once say that the people who have apparently no risk factors are the ones that scare you the most.
In my practice, I used to selectively use coronary calcium among people I was concerned about their risk factors. And I realized the greatest risk factor for a heart attack in my practice was the lack of risk factors.
Yeah.
Because you were the person I was ignoring. You're the person I was not treating. Now that I have a heart scan, I have a coronary calcium score. I don't have to guess if you have heart disease. I know if you have heart disease. I know I can gauge my treatment to your level of disease. And then I can do another heart scan and find out, is it doing its job? It's hard to appreciate how important those factors are. First off, find out who has or does not have disease, how much disease they have, gauge our response to that level of disease, but then have another scan. Yes, we've met it. Your disease is stable. Your heart attack risk has come very close to disappearing.
Wow.
You are now low risk.
Wow.
Versus your plaque went up again. We're not doing everything we need to do. Let's pull back a few more layers on this onion. Let's do a little bit more and let's stabilize that plaque.
We talk about two different kinds of heart scans.
Mm-hmm.
One is a heart scan that's done on a machine which is fondly referred to as a helical mm-hmm. scanner. And there's another machine out there which is an EBT, electron beam tomography.
Right.
Does it matter which machine somebody gets a heart scan on? Because you can get a heart scan pretty much at any hospital, at any scanning facility anywhere in the United States, right?
You can, and it does matter what machine you use. Because a helical scan, basically, this is a standard CAT scanner, and the x-ray tube has to rotate around the patient. It takes a certain amount of time for that x-ray tube to rotate around the patient. And some CT scanners out there, it takes a half a second for the x-ray tube to rotate around the patient to take a picture. Well, the heart beats once a second. And so if it takes a half a second to take a picture, the heart's going to go through half its beating cycle, and it's going to give us a blurred picture, and it's going to give us a very non-reproducible calcium score. The faster the helical scanner is, the more reliable the calcium score is. But the fastest they can do is rotate around the body 3 times a second. So it still takes a third of a second to take an image. So virtually all 65 slice scanners take a third of a second to take an image. There is some blurring, there is some scan-to-scan variability that influences the accuracy of the scan. At the same time, a heart scan or 64 slice scanner is a good thing to have. But if you can do it on a higher tech machine that can capture the image quicker and is therefore more reproducible, then you have a better image. There are two types of higher tech machines. There's the electron beam or EBT, which is different than the helical because it doesn't rotate around, just shoots an electron beam on a tungsten target, you get an instantaneous flash of imaging. It takes a picture in a tenth of a second. In a tenth of a second, you capture the heart without motion. So the imaging is so accurate, you can do another heart scan in a year and accurately compare the scores. With a 64-slice scan, if you do a heart scan in a year, follow up in a year, the scan-to-scan variability is going to kind of overwhelm the change. Probably have to wait 2 or 3 years with most 64-slice scanners. But the other exception on the helical scanners, they have this something called dual-source imaging. So even though the gantry only rotates 3 times per second, it has 2 pictures that's taken at the same time. So it can actually create an image, not in a third of a second, but in half that time, about, you know, a sixth of a second.
Right.
And a sixth of a second and a tenth of a second are pretty close to the same thing. And so this dual source, 256 or 320 slice scanners, you can get great pictures that are reproducible that can be looked at as soon as a year later. And so if you have access to either an EBT or a 256 or 320 slice dual source scanner, fabulous. That's what you ought to get. If you don't have access to that, but you do have access to a 64 slice scanner, go for it.
Anything's better than nothing?
Anything's better than nothing.
So the real buzzword to make it easy for us all to remember is EBT, or we could just remember dual source.
Dual source, right.
So if we call a facility and say, do you have a dual source CAT scanner, because it's CAT scanner, then
that'll
we'll
be a
know
beautiful
that.
Thing. Yes.
Okay. A lot of people are afraid to get a heart scan because they say, if they find something, I'm going to end up at the cardiologist and I'm going to have a stent and a bypass, and et cetera, et cetera.
Problem there is when you get the heart scan, we're in the new world of preventing heart disease. We're in the world of finding out what your risk is, putting in therapies that will change that risk, make that risk go away. The problem is we're stuck in the old world where the way to treat heart disease is to do a treadmill test, find an obstruction, and fix it with a stent or bypass. And people are reluctant to do that because they know Uncle Ed. And Uncle Ed just went in for, he's having a little bit of chest pain, but doing fine, just a little chest pain. And they put him on a treadmill, they find his heart disease, they open him up to do a bypass. Uncle Ed's never been the same since.
Right.
I don't want to have happen to me what happened to Uncle Ed. Well, here's the problem. Heart disease is not a disease that can be fixed by fixing obstructions. We now have in the literature 9 randomized prospective trials showing that putting an elective stent into someone who's failed their stress test reduces their heart attack risk by 0% and reduces their risk of death by 0%. You've done nothing to improve their outcomes.
Yeah.
And you've put them through a bunch of expensive, uncomfortable, unpleasant procedures. And so if you go in without symptoms and you have a heart scan and you have a high score and your doctor says, do a stress test, that's the wrong answer. That's the wrong answer. Because the only potential for benefit with the stenting in that circumstance is if you were having so much chest pain you couldn't function. It's the only value for stenting. If you go in there and you're asymptomatic and you just have a heart scan and your doctor says, let's look for a reason to put in a stent, they're doing the wrong thing.
And that's regardless of what your score is.
That's regardless of what your score is. The higher the score, the more likely you are to have obstructive disease. But it's not your obstructive disease that's going to kill you. It's the disease in the wall of the vessel that ruptures, fills the vessel with clot. That's what causes heart attacks. That's what kills people. And fixing the obstruction does nothing to the disease in the walls of the vessels that's going to rupture and fill the vessel with clot.
I'm glad you said that because everybody, it seems like, is overly concerned with blockages. Am I blocked? Does this mean I have a blockage?
Blockage. Right. And it's not about the blockage.
Say that again.
It is not about the blockage. There's actually a study showing that people who do have blockages in their vessels, who subsequently have heart attacks, are more likely to survive the heart attack than people who had no blockages before their plaque ruptured, filled the vessel with clot, and caused the heart attack.
Why is that?
When you have a blockage, the muscle distal to that blockage sometimes doesn't get enough oxygen, enough blood flow, so your body creates collateral circulation around the blockage.
So it builds like new arteries?
New arteries, new tributaries to provide blood flow to that muscle. So if the main artery clogs up, you have these secondary arteries that built around the blockage, and the heart muscle stays alive. I've had multiple cases of patients whose vessels have completely blocked off, and yet they did not have a heart attack.
Did they know that they're they
in
were
some
blocked?
Cases they do. Yeah, I mean, I have one patient now, he's in his 80s, very physically active, and he had had a previous stent.
Uh-huh.
And that stent closed down on him, did not have a heart attack. He had a diminished exercise tolerance. And when we looked, we saw, oh, that stent's now closed. But in the 9 months since that happened, he has had a graduated exercise program, and he has gotten rid of his chest pain. He's gotten rid of his palpitations simply by allowing his body to create collateral circulation.
So they didn't put in a new stent or open up the stent?
Well, they couldn't open up the stent. When they were studying him, they couldn't help but put in a couple of stents here and there.
Right. Of course.
But after a couple of stents here and there, he still was very limited and would get some chest tightness when he was walking. But by treating his risk factors appropriately, being on the right diet, the right supplements, the right medications, treating his blood pressure appropriately.
Right.
He has now gotten rid of the chest pain, and he can go skiing without chest pain.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Now, he gets tired a little bit faster than he'd like to, but the chest pain is gone.
And he's also 80 years old.
He's also 80 years old, yeah.
You've mentioned stents a couple of times.
Yes.
And I've also heard people say, well, yeah, I know I have heart disease, but they put a stent in, so I'm fine.
Oh, my God, yes. Basically, when you have heart disease and you get a stent, now you have two diseases. You have heart disease and you have stent disease, because stents provide their own set of problems. Stents will plug up with clot. Stents will glob on platelets. Stents require that you take medications that increase your risk of bleeding. Stents are not your friend. Happily, we can report across the board that stents do not increase cardiac death.
Good.
But they certainly don't improve it. The most important point is, after you've gotten your stent, remember you have not treated your disease.
So you still should get a heart scan.
You still should get a heart scan. You still should be on very aggressive treatment to the point your heart scan is stable. The fact that you got a stent did nothing to reduce your risk for a heart attack. You need to do that now. You need to get on the right diet, the right supplements, make the changes you need to make, keep your heart attack from happening.
What do you say to people who say, well, my doctor told me not to get a heart scan, that it's meaningless? Or the other thing they say is, my doctor told me that even if you get a heart scan, regardless of what it tells you, there's nothing you can do about it.
Right. All I can tell them is their doctor is wrong.
Change your doctor?
Well, not necessarily. Maybe educate your doctor. Your doctor has been listening to the East Coast geniuses who tell them exactly that. They have not been looking at the horrible statistics, which is that over 2,000 people die every day from heart attacks. They have not looked at the fact that the literature is very, very clear about it. The heart scan is dramatically better than all other ways to assess your risk for a heart attack. A simple coronary calcium score is more accurate at predicting your risk for a heart attack than an invasive coronary angiogram.
Why is that? An angiogram is where they put the camera up look in your arteries, right?
Right.
And people will say, well, I passed my angiogram, I'm fine, because they looked in all my arteries.
Right.
So that's not true.
Well, they had this study of over 200 patients who had a coronary angiogram and a calcium score the same day, and they followed them up 7 years later. They found that the results of the calcium score were more predictive for heart attack risk than the results of the angiogram. And this group of 270 patients, there was no correlation between conventional risk factors and who had and who did not have a heart attack. However, the calcium score greater than 100 strongly correlated with risk for heart attack in this group. And so what happens is, when you first start getting plaque, it does not make your vessel smaller that shows up on the angiogram. Initially, it causes the outer wall of the vessel to bulge outward. So the lumen where the blood flows looks the same, but the heart scan can see the plaque bulge the vessel outward by measuring the calcium score. And so it's more sensitive than a conventional angiogram in figuring out who does and who does not have heart disease. In fact, 1/3 of the people with heart disease will have a normal conventional angiogram, but a positive calcium score.
How about the people that say, not only did I pass my angiogram, I passed my stress test?
They have this beautiful study on stress tests. 1,800 men underwent a stress test, and then they followed them prospectively. 84% of the heart attacks occurred in the men who passed their stress test.
Oh, my goodness.
Only 16% of the heart attacks occurred in the men who failed their stress test. If you passed your stress test in this particular study, your pre-test risk for heart attack was 0.9%. Your post-test risk for heart attack was 0.9%. Passing the stress test did nothing to change your risk for heart attack. If you failed the stress test, your pre-test risk was 0.9%. Your post-test risk went up to actually 1.6% annual risk for heart attack. So it did increase it if you failed the test. But the difference was not impressive. And the vast majority, 84% of the people who had heart attacks, were among the group who passed their stress test.
Amazing.
And so to do a stress test is painfully foolish as a screening tool for coronary disease. Now, if you want to say, an elite athlete, look, I can go this far in my stress test, fine. You want points doing that? Good for you. If you're having chest pain and you want to say, is my chest pain due to coronary disease, you can get on a stress test, and you know, as long as you're not one of the 25% who get a false positive.
Which is a lot.
So one of 20 of the people without disease who get a positive stress test and then go on and do more invasive tests for no reason, or part of the 25% of people with disease who have a normal stress test and are given a pat on the back saying you have no problems, or 100% of the people who have no obstructive disease, just disease in the walls of the vessel, that will do great on a stress test despite the fact they could have a heart attack tomorrow. You know, it's ask Tim Russert. Remember Tim Russert,
yes,
the famous journalist?
Mm-hmm.
He had a stress test and 5 weeks later is dead from a heart attack.
Well, another one is Clinton.
Bill Clinton, yeah.
He spent, what, he had 5 stress tests in a row that he passed.
Yeah, and he had a heart scan they did terrible on, but his doctors didn't know what to do with it. So when he passed the stress test, they said, false positive heart scan, don't worry about it. And Bill Clinton almost died.
Right.
And I'm sure his hospital bill was way up in the hundreds of thousands of dollars based on a bad judgment on his doctor's part by not listening to his heart scan, which told them what they needed to know, but rather listen to his stress test, which told them the wrong answer.
What do people do? You don't need a doctor's referral for a heart scan. So I understand that it's really easy to call up scanning facilities and say, do you have an EBT or do you have a dual source CAT scanner where I can get a heart scan? And they go, yes. So you go in and you get a heart scan.
Correct.
Then you get a score. Let's say you have a positive score. So because the score is 0 is a high five, you're terrific.
That's right. Come back in 3 to 5 years.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But you have a positive score.
Sure.
And you go to your doctor and you've already listened to this radio show. Mm-hmm. You don't have chest pain. You're asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. You show this to your doctor and goes, oh my God, I wish you hadn't done this because now I got to send you over to Dr. Cardiologist and give you a stress test.
Right.
Where do we, the public, get the ammunition to explain to our doctor that maybe there's another way?
Yeah. There's a cardiologist at UCLA named Matt Budoff. And Matt Budoff is one of the world authorities on coronary calcium. And his position is there is no calcium score that in and of itself is an indication for a stress test.
Or a
trip to the cardiologist.
Okay.
But cardiologists make billions doing stress tests. We did 10 million nuclear stress tests in this country last year at roughly $1,000 a pop. That's $10 billion worth of nuclear stress tests. It's a very profitable industry. We're always looking for an excuse to do a nuclear stress test. Why not use a calcium score as an excuse?
Right.
And so they do, but it's not going to add any value. If you have a positive calcium score, you know you have heart disease. If you're not having chest pain, we're not going to improve you in any way, shape, or form by doing a stress test or putting in a stent. But we know you need to be treated, so just start getting treated. Skip the stress test, skip the stent, just start getting treated for your positive calcium score.
And that's our last question.
All right.
How do we get treated?
Well, the first thing is quit smoking. If you smoke, quit smoking, because that's the number one risk factor. It's completely modifiable. Just quit smoking. Secondly, diet. Well, what do I mean diet? Do I mean the American Heart Association low-fat diet? No, I don't. Diet that's very high in fruits, vegetables, pigmented berries, has plenty of the good fats, olive oil, avocado, tree nuts, almonds, walnuts, fish oil. You don't actually have to worry about animal fats, so a piece of red meat is not toxic. Chicken with the skin on, brown meat chicken, is not toxic. So you can have delicious proteins with animal fats. Saturated fats are not the problem. The biggest problem is sugars and starches, so you have to really cut back on sugars and starches, pastas, bread, you know, things of that nature, because those create inflammation and tend to promote heart disease. So that's a dietary thing. It's more increasing the good stuff. When you increase the good stuff, you don't really have that much room for the starches and the pastas and stuff like that because you have plenty of vegetables, you have the meats, you have the good fats, number one. Number two is exercise, a 20-minute daily walk at 3 miles an hour. Not excessive. It's a wonderful exercise. You'll enjoy doing it. You'll feel better doing it. Your brain will work better doing it. You'll have less degenerative neurologic disorders. Your eyes will stay healthier longer. A 20-minute daily walk. Study in Tufts found a 50% reduction in heart attacks based on a 20-minute daily walk. Excellent dental hygiene, brushing every day, flossing at least once a day, seeing your dentist periodically.
Don't have sleep apnea, right?
Monitor for sleep apnea, get tested for sleep apnea, make sure if you have it, it's treated. That's the basic thing. Make sure your blood pressure is well controlled, make sure you don't have diabetes. And for some people, low-dose statin is a reasonable drug. It's not something that everyone should be on, and we shouldn't all be on high-dose statins, as the East Coast group of physicians think we should. They're wrong. Again, you know, the same people who brought you the low-fat diet bring you the high-dose statin diet. They're wrong. But a low-dose statin can have an incremental benefit. But other supplements like vitamin D, fish oil, niacin, aged garlic extract, vitamin K2, those things add a very demonstrable value, are very inexpensive, and are very low in toxicities.
And have to be the right kind and the right amount.
Have to be the right kind and the right amount of vitamin D, of niacin, of fish oil omega-3. But it's there. It's fairly straightforward. It can be done. This is not hard to do. And then you put it all together, and at the end of the day, people's plaque scores stabilize. At the end of the day, their heart attack risk goes away.
I would venture to say that every one of our listeners has somebody who's at 1 degree of separation, has had an experience with a sudden death heart attack. It's 1 in 4 people.
Yeah.
That is highly prevalent.
It's huge.
Can we save them?
We can.
Can people save ourselves?
My grandfather died when he was 70. I have a cousin who died when I was 45 from a sudden death from a heart attack. It's a tragedy. It's horrible. And it doesn't have to happen.
And all we have to do is
get a heart scan, because the heart scan will tell you, are you in the 50% of the population that has a zero score, in which case your annual risk for heart attack is so low that taking a statin is more likely to make you sick than make you well. 50% of the people at risk will have a zero score. That's good news. If you have a positive score, how positive is it? Will also give us some information as to how aggressively do we need to monitor this? How aggressively do we need to manage it?
And we don't need to be afraid of a high score?
Well, the high score tells you what you have. It didn't give it to you.
Right.
It's what you have. Now you know what you got. You know how to respond to it, and you can beat it. You know, I have dozens of patients with scores over 1,000. Their annual risk of heart attacks should be 1 in 5. They don't have heart attacks. Their plaque score is stable.
If those people who have the scores over 1,000 have stabilized their plaque, what's their risk down to about?
Less than 0.5%.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
Now, I do have one patient who, in my highest plaque score, he read the Harvard newsletter. He stopped his niacin. He stopped his fish oil. He continued taking a statin, but he stopped his niacin and fish oil because the Harvard newsletter said it didn't work. Well, he got out of the hospital after his bypass last month, and he's decided to get back on his niacin fish oil because he went 7 years without a symptom or progression of his plaque, stopped his niacin, stopped his fish oil, got progression of his plaque on his calcium score, and ended up getting a bypass.
Totally against your thing.